Chapter 22. Hesho and I appeared in the cafeteria, but I judged things wrong. Dinner was already over, and a group of rookie ground troops were busy wiping down the tables. A few looked at me and jumped. The old me would have appreciated the fearsome reputation I'd cultivated. Today, the panic of having missed the others was far more potent. Hesho hovered up beside my head, then turned a masked face toward me, seeming confused.
"We're not too late," he said. "Look, they have some of the latecomer meals."
He pointed to the sandwiches prepared for those with irregular shifts. I grabbed two because I was starving and wanted enough to share with Hesho, but this wasn't actually why we'd come. I had to find the others. A part of me realized that my sudden urgency was silly. There would be more times to chat with my friends. But I'd noticed a welling up need, a solution to my own anxiety that had to be filled. I wanted to see them. Chet wanted to see them. Both of us needed this, right now. And I'd missed the chance to be part of what was normally one of the most... Wait. It was Thursday. I waved to Hesho, then turned down the hallway. Not hyper-jumping, but moving at a brisk, almost run toward the hangar bays. I pushed open the door, then let out a relieved sigh. They were here. Thursday was our flight's time in the hangar for maintenance, which was something of a misnomer since the ground crews did most of the difficult work. They replaced parts and ran detailed diagnostics. That left the pilots to do our pre-flight checklist each time we went into the air and what we did on Thursdays. Wash the ships. It was more ritual than requirement. We rarely flew in atmosphere anymore, and the ships didn't get as dirty as they once had. But there was a bond between a pilot and her ship, and it helped to actively care for it. So once a week, we came in here to give the ships a bath and a polish. As was tradition, everyone had gathered around one of the ships to work on it together. At the moment, wearing somewhat soggy, dark green maintenance jumpsuits, they were working on Arturo's Poco, wiping char off the sides near the boosters, scrubbing the white panels until they shone, giving the canopy a good polish. As soon as I burst in, Kimmelin turned, then grinned widely and waved to me. I hesitantly made my way forward. I knew I shouldn't feel awkward rejoining them. I'd helped forge this team. But things had been off ever since I'd come back, with my soul trying to rip out of my body and my powers being strange and... Thwack. A wet towel hit me in the face as Ned trotted by. It peeled off and fell into my hands. Wait, Ned was here? Out of the infirmary? He looked pretty good, all things considered, with one sleeve sewn up just above the elbow. He glanced at that, following my sightline, then winked.
"Best excuse I've ever had to take a nap while Arturo works," he said. "Too bad the medics say they'll get me a prosthetic arm with fingers that can move. I've got to milk this for every ounce of sympathy I can before I become Cyborg Ned."
A prosthetic arm? We'd assumed his flying career was finished, as our technology wasn't particularly advanced in the realm of cybernetics. But maybe it was better than I thought. Perhaps my failure wasn't as costly as I'd feared. It was still my fault that he'd been hurt. I tried to force out the words.
"Come on," he said, cutting me off. "We saved the messiest part for you."
He grinned, then thumbed toward the ship's landing skids.
"Ned," Arturo called. "She hasn't come to a single one of these since she got back. We didn't save anything for her."
"Sure we did," Ned called back. "We saved them for me, and by tradition, I waited for a way to make someone else do them."
He put his good arm out and grinned while giving me a side hug. And, well, everything wasn't all right. Things were still strange. But I no longer felt like leaving.
"You should know better than to give me a dangerous weapon, Ned," I said to him, twisting the towel. "Scud no," he said, dodging out of the way as I tried to whip it at him. "You're the best one to hold the dangerous weapon. Then people aim at you instead of me and we're all happy."
He ambled back toward the ship, and I started after him, then glanced at Hesho,
who sat straight upright in his seat in the little hover disc. He had his white and red mask on, so I couldn't see his expression, but from his prim posture and tightly gripped fists, he seemed alarmed. He'd seen how we treated each other before, but I guessed maybe he found this even more extreme. "This is normal," I said to him, wolfing down a sandwich.
"It is."
"Yep. Trust me. This is good." He hovered beside me as I finished the sandwich and knelt to begin cleaning the landing gear. And despite what Ned had said earlier, he got down with me and joined in, working with his good arm. Sadie, grinning, flipped down underneath the front of the ship, then hung just above us from a belt that she'd wrapped around the nose and began polishing. "Sadie," I asked, "did you strap yourself in so you could clean upside down?"
"So much easier this way," she said. "Don't have to crane your neck."
"I'd fall asleep," Ned said from beside me. "Too much like a hammock."
"Oh?" Kimmelin replied, ducking down to look at us.
"Are you implying that you need to be comfortable to take a nap, Ned? I've got you sleeping in the most ridiculous positions." "See? That's the thing," he said. "Once you fall asleep, you don't notice anymore."
"'Cause you're unconscious."
"So, sleeping when you're uncomfortable is really the best way to approach life."
"And sleeping when you're comfortable?" I asked.
"Also the best way to approach life," he said.
"Bless your stars," Kimmelin said.
"Nah, but you can bless my snores," he said, grinning as he dug harder into the caked-on gunk on the landing gear.
Hesho hovered a little closer and picked his own section, some gears that were too tight for us to reach into, and cleaned there with a very small rag. "You all know my friend, Mask?" I said.
"Yep," Ned said.
"I must admit," Hesho said to them, "I am not accustomed to interactions of this sort. Please don't mistake my stiffness for dislike."
"That's right," Ned said, wagging his rag at Hesho. "Mask, I heard you were someone real important before."
I was," Hesho said. "But I don't know if we should discuss."
I gave Ned a glance, but he winked at me.
"I heard," he continued, "you were a babysitter."
"Yeah," Sadie said. "Like, you had to wrangle preschoolers. An entire country's worth of them."
"Seems like it would be a relief not to have to deal with that sort of thing anymore," Ned said, still working. "I feel for you, my friend. When did you ever get to take a nap?"
Hesho paused, then seemed amused as he responded.
"Well, I shall say I did not get to take many. It was quite the project, wrangling all those preschoolers. I often didn't even have time for meditation or composing poetry."
Ned gasped.
"No poetry?"
"You compose poetry, Nedder?" Hesho asked.
"I love the stuff," Ned said.
"You do not compose poetry," Arturo said, walking past.
"Forgive him," Ned said. "His wit's as thick as a Tewksbury mustard."
"As what?" I asked.
"It's Shakespeare," Ned said.
Nearby, Arturo froze. He pulled out his data pad and looked through it, then looked back at Ned, his jaw dropping.
"It is Shakespeare, from Henry IV.
"A most notable coward," Ned said, thumbing toward Arturo. "An infinite and endless liar, an hourly promise breaker, the owner of no one good quality."
"Man, that dude had the best insults. I love them."
"Who is this again?" I asked.
"Ancient English dude," Ned said. "Wrote poetry. A lot of it survived the destruction of the Defiant and our records. You'd like him, Spin. Surprised your grandma didn't tell you stories about him. You know, Hamlet and crud like that."
"Hamlet," I said.
"It is the single most famous work of human literature," Hesho replied. "Even I have studied it. And I find, Nedder, your taste in insults to be exceptional. You are obviously a man of great refinement.
See, Arturo? Ned said. The preschool teacher agrees with me.
He gave Hesho a wide grin. Nearby, Arturo was still staring, slack-jawed, as if he'd found out that his mother had secretly been a ninja all his life.
You, he said, have memorized quotes from Shakespeare.
Forgive Amphi, Ned said, leaning closer to Hesho. He's a little on the slow side sometimes. We try to be accommodating.
Oh, scud, Arturo said, stalking off to join Alanik,
who was preparing more buckets and soap for the next ship in line. Hesho seemed to understand it was teasing, though. He was nodding behind his formal mask and looked relaxed. FM was moving up beneath the ship, polishing as she went. I realized then that everyone was soaking, except her. Somehow she always avoided getting hit, while I, if present, generally ended up the most wet. Naturally, I always took someone down with me.
Hey, Mask, FM said. Your people used to visit ours, right? Long ago? I've talked to Juno about it.
The Lore Keeper? Hesho asked. How do you know him?
He and Jorgen hang out a lot, FM said.
I wasn't aware that Juno hung out as a general rule, Hesho said.
Well, he calls it training, but I think they just like to chat, FM said. He was really helpful when Jorgen trained to cut things in half with his mind. As one does, Ned said.
I wish I could cut things in half with my mind, Sadie said, still hanging upside down. It would make it so much easier to get my rations open. Why do they seal the field rations so tight?
I doubt Jorgen uses his powers for such mundane things, Sentry, Kimmelin said. I didn't contradict her. Anyway, Mask, FM said, I've been thinking. You've been flying with Spencer, right?
It is my privilege to join her in the cockpit, he answered. And I believe I've been of service, helping her navigate and monitor controls while in combat.
And Jorgen flew with Juno, FM said. Juno helped him learn to meditate.
Jorgen learned meditation, I said, while in battle? I hadn't heard that part.
Basically, yeah, FM said.
She squatted down beside where Hesho, Ned, and I worked.
I've been looking at schematics. We build our ships the size we do for a reason. They're optimized, just big enough to maintain maneuverability and to carry large enough guns for damage.
Indeed, Hesho said. When we started building our own starships, we initially began with much smaller designs, scaled to our size. However, we found that they lacked the necessary firepower to be meaningful on the galactic stage. We eventually settled on designs not much different in size from your own.
Many species have ended up with the same sizes of ships, she said, excited.
Scud.
You've been thinking the same thing I have, I said, pointing to her. Furry co-pilots? She asked.
Furry co-pilots.
What? Ned asked. Most of the ships we build are one-person vessels, FM explained. Two-seaters sacrifice speed for the extra bulk, so we don't generally use them as interceptors. But having a co-pilot is probably super useful.
It is, I said. Part of the reason I was so good when flying M'Bot's old ship was that he could take over some of the duties for me, monitoring proximity, giving me a heads up on ships coming our way. It's been incredibly useful to have Hesho doing the same duties.
Yes, Hesho said softly. Having a second pilot who does not take up much space and can be fit into a normal cockpit without modifications is a huge advantage to Spencer and me.
Exactly, FM said. Do you think any of the others in your fleet would be interested in trying it out?
I know many who would love to do so, Hesho said. Our officer training involves a lot of redundant positions on various stations. We have junior staff who are eager for combat and status, but who rarely get a chance. I think If you were to approach the proper heads of the military and state, this idea would eagerly be accepted.
Heads of state, eh?
Ned said, whacking the now-clean landing gear with his rag.
Scud, it felt so wonderful to see him again, and for him to be taking his injury in stride.
But what else had I expected from Ned?
Hey, Spin, what position in line do you think I am for head of our government?
None, I said flatly. You are not in line.
Sure I am, Ned said. The DDF isn't actually that large. What are we, 6,000 people? And now the military is in direct command. I'm a lieutenant, so...
Oh, Scud. He was right. I'd never really thought of it, but technically Ned was in the chain of command. Kimmelin grabbed her data pad with a mischievous grin.
One admiral of the fleet, 4 vice admirals, currently 9 rear admirals, captains, commanders, lieutenant commanders. Let's assume every lieutenant is ahead of Ned.
Well, FM said, still squatting nearby, what is the horrible verdict?
117th, she admitted, in line for command of the DDF, which, until we organize another national assembly, is the de facto ruling body of the planet.
In my government, you'd be the equivalent of a senatorial body head, Netter,
Hesho offered.
A very senior and distinguished position, fit for a master poet such as yourself.
Hell yeah, he said.
Saint help us if it came to that, Arturo said.
You'd be dead, Kimmelin said, since you're ahead of him in the line of succession.
Well, you'd have that going for you at least, Alanique said, giving Ned a smile and setting down a fresh bucket of soapy water for him.
I'll beat thee, Ned quoted, hand to his chest. But I would infect my hands.
I glanced at Hesho, who still hovered next to the group of us underneath the front fuselage of the ship. How was he taking this? He looked from Ned to the others, then, remarkably, took off his mask and set it beside him. A grin marked his snout as he leaned forward.
"'Twas not a friend, and not a foe, who did besmirch thee, but merely a foul wind, not worthy of retort."
"Oh," Ned said. "I don't know that one."
"It's from one of our poets," Hesho said. "My great-great-great-grandfather was a playwright and fond of insults."
"Scud," Ned said. "A Kitson Shakespeare? Can I read his stuff?"
"It would be my greatest honor to share it with you. Then you will have an entirely new repertoire of poetic deprecations at your disposal."
"Awesome," Ned said, raising his fist to Hesho. "Fight the man."
"The man?" Hesho asked.
"Him, mostly," Ned said, indicating Arturo. "Except when he pays for snacks. Then he's not the man, he's the man."
"The intricacies of your language are indeed intriguing," Hesho said. "Do you know of any other human poets that I should investigate?"
"Unfortunately, our archives are super fragmented," Ned said. "But there was this legendary poet named David Bowie, who may or may not have actually been real."
The two continued chatting as I stepped away from the ship and stretched. Feeling thirsty, I wandered over to the water station, and Kimmelin joined me a moment later.
"Did you bring Hesho?" she said, "just to try to get him to open up to us?"
I nodded, surprised she'd been able to read me that well. "You all got through to me," I said. "I figured Hesho can't be that much harder."
"That was compassionate of you, Spin," Kimmelin said. "Hesho must feel so much loss, being cast from his position as he was."
"He wasn't cast from it," I explained, watching Hesho speak animatedly to Ned and the others. "He chose, but it's still hard on him. I thought maybe he needed some more friends."
"Smart," Kimmelin said.
then looked at me, thoughtfully. You're going to remind me, yet again, that you're here for me if I need you, I said, right?
Damn straight, she said, squeezing my arm. I heard you took a plan to Jorgen. You wanted to attack right now?
I nodded.
But we're not going to, Kimmelin said. I shook my head. How are you doing with that?
Strangely fine, I said, meeting her brown eyes. I talked to Hesho earlier and, well, I think I'm going to be all right letting Jorgen lead.
Kimmelin smiled. She didn't head back to the others immediately, though. She leaned against the water station, giving me space by not demanding more answers, but also staying near. Though I hadn't made any conscious decisions, I felt as if the matter was resolved. I wasn't going to run off on my own this time. Hesho was right. More profoundly, this team was right. Felt right. This was my home. I'd been away for too long, but being here, watching my friends laugh, knowing they were watching out for me, I felt a warmth that was in direct contrast to the strange feelings of loss I'd been experiencing. Like light in a cavern beating back the darkness, their presence changed me. Us. Chet felt it too. For my whole life, I'd believed I just needed to fly. That was what I'd hunted, what had driven me. But in the end, that wasn't what actually mattered most. I gave Kimmelin a smile. Things are coming together for me, finally. Thank you for being patient. For now, what if we went and invited Shiver and Liz to join us? I bet they're feeling out of place and lonely too. They're pilots, and being around ships and people working on them might be comforting. Kimmelin grinned, and so we told the others, then went to check on the two resonants. They'd been assigned quarters nearby, and after knocking and getting permission, we entered to find the two crystalline beings sitting in chairs. The rooms weren't furnished with much, but I doubted that mattered to the resonants. More tellingly, though, their crystals hadn't expanded far. They'd barely grown around the chairs, which indicated to me that they weren't comfortable here.
Spin, Shiver said. I was hoping you'd come. Deliz is getting even better.
Deliz sent me images I couldn't quite parse. Empty caverns, a lonely crystal, but a rising sun as well, sparkling through a tunnel full of different kinds of crystals. I took it in and thought maybe it meant she was happy. But still, there was the impression that she was also missing something. We were just wondering if you two wanted to come see some of our starfighters, I said to them. We're doing maintenance on them now, and I figured it would be a good time.
Really? Shiver asked. You'd let us? We're aliens. Former pirates, Spin. Surely we don't belong.
You'd be surprised, Kimmelin said with a warm smile. We've lived our entire lives short-staffed. If you can fly and are willing, you're welcome. If you want, I can even talk to Command about getting you commissions.
No need to commit to something like that, I said quickly. The offer to take you home to your caverns once this is over still stands. We can probably hyperjump you there. I got hit with an immediate set of visualizations from Deliz. The sky, the wind, the fragments of the nowhere, soaring. It was self-explanatory. Once you'd had that, going back to a few caverns wasn't an option. Scud, how had I ever thought otherwise? After a quick call to Command for permission, we brought the two resonants to join the others. And interestingly, it was Hesho who spoke to them first, welcoming them in as Ned had welcomed him. They would fit right into the flight, I was certain. I'd push for it, as I had this feeling that the more different types of people we got into the flight, the stronger it would be. I watched them for a moment, but there was one more thing to do. As I realized earlier, I wanted my friends to help build Embot's new body. They would love it, and the activity would give us a further chance to bond with Hesho and the Resonance. I vanished and reappeared in the cavern, startling Doomslug, who had wanted to stay when we'd left.
She fluted at me from where she'd snuggled in on the table, seeming content and happy there. The Tanix might have enjoyed being with us humans, but for them, these musty caverns felt like home. And that was just fine. I gave her a scritch on the head and along her flutes before putting my hands on my hips and looking at the mess Hesho and I had made of these parts. I'd have to pile them all up, then hyperjump them back up into the hangar. Or maybe it would just be easier to bring everyone down here? Seeing it all there, unfortunately, gave me a moment of panic. It reminded me of when I'd discovered M'Bot torn apart on Starsight, and the feelings of panic and sorrow I'd felt at losing him. I was struck by a disorientation, and the air started to warp around me. A metal cup from the hangar, the one I'd been drinking out of, dropped out of midair and clanged to the ground. Fighting the episode down was easier this time. The effects of having been around the others lingered with me, and I was proud of how well I handled the sudden panic. Indeed, everything seemed fine. Right up until the moment Doomslug fluted in alarm. A second later, something hit me from behind, an electric bolt of energy that coursed through my body, leaving me weak and trembling as I dropped to the hard stone. Doomslug's fluting trailed off abruptly. A new panic arose in me. What was happening? I tried to move, but I'd been stunned, my muscles flexing and unflexing uncontrollably. I even started drooling, though my eyes worked fine, and so I could see clearly when someone grabbed me by the shoulder and turned me over. Braid. Wearing black combat gear and a flak jacket, backed up by 5 soldiers in similar gear, holding assault rifles.
Good, Braid said. It's her.
One of the others was holding a limp Doomslug in their arms. I tried to struggle, froth bubbling at my lips. If they had hurt her... Braid looked up as the air warped again. Something crashed to the ground nearby, and pieces of the table vanished. Then... oddly, she smiled.
Leave the note, she said to one of the soldiers. You, squeeze that slug.
He squeezed Doomslug, and I panicked further. The air warped again, and only then did I realize what Braid was doing. When I broke the air apart in my wave of panic, it had opened a path through our inhibitors, which had let her slip in, and not just in my mind this time. She was physically here, and by hurting Doomslug, they were making me panic more, which opened a pathway for them to escape. I tried to clamp down on it, but I was too slow. Braid hauled me up and over her shoulder, then the other soldiers each put a hand on her arm. A second later, we hyperjumped away, and I felt a sudden spike of dread. Not just because I was now in enemy hands, but because I knew what everyone was going to think. They'd assume that I had gone off on my own again. I wasn't merely in serious danger. I'd likely just broken the hearts of Jorgen and my other friends yet again.
Part 3. Chapter 23. We appeared in a round room with screens all along a back wall. I vaguely recognized it. I'd seen Braid and Winzik in here once while spying on them from the nowhere. Then, it had been filled with officials and generals listening to Winzik. Now, it was empty, save for the Varvax himself. Tall in his suit made of sandstone, a blocky and modern version of ancient knight's armor, the real Winzik was the crab-like creature floating in the liquid behind the helmet's glass faceplate. The Varvax had learned to craft a stronger shell material early in their technological development, which eventually was developed into this type of suit, just as making steel had come early during human development. Braid dropped me onto the floor in front of Winzik like a prized stag slain during the hunt. I flopped onto my back, drooling as she waved proudly toward me, an intolerable grin on her face.
Done, she said. I told you I could manage it.
My, my, Winzik said,
waving his armored arms as he knelt down on one stone knee beside me. Varvak spoke with their hands as much as with their voices, which were projected from the front of their suits.
So careless with our guest, Braid. So brutal.
Yeah, Braid said. Wait until she rips your face off with a mind blade.
I have 10 different inhibitors in here,
Winzik said, gesturing in a way that felt indifferent.
I still think we should have waited to see if she'd come to you willingly to duel.
She wasn't going to, Braid said. I could feel it. Better to strike when I sensed she was alone. I focused on her and felt the unnatural sense of disconnect rising from me again. The trembling distortion, loss, and pain. This time I stoked those emotions, remembering Embot's body torn apart and the moment of panic I'd felt when thinking he was dead. The room shook like a meteor had hit nearby. Screws began to rain down like chips of stone from a crumbling cavern ceiling, hundreds of them, stolen from somewhere by my powers to tumble down through the room and rattle and click against the metal surfaces. Winzik leaped to his feet and shied backward, waving sandstone hands anxiously. Whatever it was I'd become, I could rip through their inhibitor fields, just like I'd ripped a hole in ours. If Braid could sneak into detritus to get me, then I could get right back out. As the air continued to undulate and warp around me, I reached out with my mind. My infirm body, still stunned, didn't need to be. Braid knelt beside me and rammed something into my neck. A syringe. I tried to snap at her fingers with my mouth, but only succeeded in blowing a few bubbles in my drool. She watched me, genuine worry on her face, until the warping subsided. No, I thought, trying to focus on my pain, on the loss, the anguish. It was still there, but now it didn't do anything. The room settled, a last spurt of bolts falling from the air before all grew still.
Chet, I thought at the Delver in my soul. No response.
Chet! Embot? Anyone?
Somehow, whatever they'd drugged me with had cut me off from them, and the nowhere, completely. It was as if I wasn't even Cytonic. Braid exhaled in relief. Then a confident smile reappeared on her lips, and she became the lounging, cocky fighter she always seemed to be around Winzik. A completely different persona from the stoic, troubled loner she'd shown me in my flight at Starsight. I was certain she'd been genuinely worried for a moment. She hadn't known if that drug she'd given me would work or not. Unfortunately, it had. My cytonic senses were completely closed off. It didn't feel the way an inhibitor did. That felt like pushing against a wall with my mind. Now it felt like there was nothing to push against, and I couldn't generate any kind of force to try. What had they done? What was that stuff they'd injected into me? It wouldn't be permanent, would it?
I warned you she would still be dangerous, Braid said, stepping back as Winzik approached. Kapling, store that slug with the others. The rest of you outside.
The soldiers who had arrived with her backed away, one with Doomslug still in his arms. I had a single bit of solace. They didn't seem to know that Doomslug was my friend, not just a tool. Her panicked fluting broke my heart, but there was nothing I could do. I could barely twitch my head.
My, my, Winzik said, his voice low, gestures subdued. It does work on humans. Good, good.
I felt something deeper, more potent than my pain. Anger. Fury at this creature, boiling inside of me. That little monster behind the faceplate, always so prim and calculating. He was the one who had kept my people imprisoned on Detritus. He was responsible for my father's death. The jail warden who had tried to exterminate my planet to prove he was tough. When his plot to use Delvers as a weapon had failed, he'd blamed the disaster on us, and had used that fear of Detritus, of humans, to execute his coup. Even now, he ruled because he had us as a boogeyman. So much death, so much destruction, so many lies. Also, this thing could rise through the ranks.
I'd almost have respected him if he were a warrior. But the sad, humiliating truth was that our world hadn't been dominated for years by some ruthless warlord, but by a bureaucrat who knew how to manipulate public opinion. That revelation about the workings of the universe, more than anything else, enraged me. I snarled softly, and Winzik waved his hands and looked to Braid.
"You didn't stun her enough, Braid," he said. "She should have been unconscious before you brought her here."
"We needed her conscious to get back, Winzik," Braid said, "and you needed to see what she's capable of doing. There's something very strange about her. That's why the Delvers are frightened of her. Not just because she's a powerful Cytonic. She's moved beyond that somehow. She has powers like a Delver."
"Take her away," Winzik said.
"I recommend against that," Braid said. "We should talk to her. She'll listen to me."
"She's too dangerous," Winzik said. "My, my. I stood in the same room with her when she hid among us. She was unbound, undrugged. So discomforting to think about."
"At least let me show the Delvers we have her," Braid said. "They'll want to know."
Scud. A piece of all this clicked into place. Their pact with the Delvers required them to deal with me specifically. That was why Braid had tried to goad me into dueling her, why they'd grabbed me. They needed me as a bargaining chip. My fears were validated as Braid turned to the side and her eyes unfocused. I felt a distant buzzing. She was reaching into the nowhere. If I hadn't been drugged, I'd have felt this more powerfully. As it was, I hoped the buzzing meant that my abilities would eventually return, that they were merely deadened for the time being. The air began warping, which made Winzik grow more agitated, though perhaps it was excitement. Braid reached down and hauled me up by the front of my jumpsuit. Being that close to her let me see better, sense better. Winzik's round conference room faded somewhat, almost becoming incorporeal, and white spots opened all around me. The eyes. The Delvers.
"See," Braid said cytonically, projecting to them vigorously enough that I could hear it.
"Here is your proof."
"We have her," Winzik said, and Braid relayed his words to the Delvers.
"As promised, you needn't fear. My, my. It was always a given that we would deliver on our contract with you."
I felt the Delvers' reactions as impressions, fear, anger, a latent pain that was thinly covered over, like a coat of paint trying to hide the old squadron insignia on the side of a starship. That was for me. Unfortunately, they sent something else to Winzik. Pleasure. Agreement.
"We have made good on our side of the deal," Winzik said. "Are you willing to move forward with yours?"
"Maybe, probably." I could feel their response.
"Maybe, probably,"
Winzik said. He could obviously feel it too. I got the sense that the reason I felt any of this was because anyone would have been able to. My cytonics deadened. I was no more sensitive than an ordinary person. "There are others like her, maybe? They could hurt us?"
"There are none," Winzik promised.
They withdrew, but not before indicating that they would consider, that they were willing. A contradiction that was hard to sort out, as their minds didn't quite work the way a human would anticipate. They hated the somewhere. Even coming here to destroy us was painful, dangerous, something they only did when forced to. That was why attacks were so rare. Still, as they vanished, I was left with an impression. As long as Winzik held me, he had power over them. They would eventually do as he wanted. Their hatred of the somewhere would be overcome by their fear of me, of what I'd become. Braid stopped reaching into the nowhere, and my anger and dread turned to nausea. If my friends launched any attacks, they would be in danger of facing Delvers. Yet here I was, not only unable to warn them, but unable to even roll over.
"Take her away,"
Winzik said, calling to the guards outside of the room.
"But," Braid said, "no," he said, "no talking to her. She's too dangerous. She will only trick us as she did before.
She has to be isolated, Braid. My, my. You must control your aggression. Please remember, we will rule not by force, but through cunning.
Braid fell silent, dropping me painfully to the ground and folding her arms. A moment later, the guards dragged me away. I was starting to get control of my body again, my fingers twitching, when they tossed me into a bleak cell, then slammed the door shut with a discouraging thump.
Chapter 24. All right. All right, I could fix this. The first thing I did was drool some more, this time by choice. I focused on my lips, on moving them, on drooling from one side of the mouth, then the other. Drool by accident, and that's embarrassing. Drool on purpose, and it's just the thirst for battle overwhelming you. Yes, that sounded silly even to me, but I needed something to focus on. You can give quarter to a worthy foe, but despair has never fit that description. Eventually, with a growl, I managed to stop drooling entirely. A short time later, I'd recovered enough to force myself into a seated position. From there, I meditated on the various things I was going to do to Winzik. It was convenient he came with such a nice trophy. I'd display that exosuit proudly in my trophy room, which, granted, I didn't have yet. But still, I would make one where I could place the semi-corpse of my greatest foe. That's right, I told myself. Focus on the anger, the determination, not on the fact that everyone at home is going to think you abandoned them. Not on the fact that the enemy is gathering their strength and has a deal with the Delvers because you handed them, in yourself, the key to facilitating that. I managed to stand. I felt like Norgay and Hillary summiting for the first time, proudly overlooking the view from the top of the tallest mountain in the world. I was able to walk off the rest of the stun. The more I worked my body, the faster it seemed to retreat. Unfortunately, the drug they'd given me to inhibit my cytonic abilities was separate from the stun gun and was still in effect. Good thing my people hadn't known about this stuff. They'd probably have put it in the water back in the day, terrified of the defect that might strike us. I continued to walk my cell, trying to figure out a plan. It was small, with a bunk, an exposed lavatory, and a solid steel door. Through a jammed open slat at the top, I could see two guards in a hallway outside. Only two? Someone was underestimating me. Keep thinking like that, I told myself. You can do this. They didn't capture you. They brought a tiger into their camp. Make them regret it. But how? I couldn't attempt to force the door. I didn't want the guards to know I was mobile yet. And so far as I could tell, the lock was solid. I could pretend I was a tiger, but I couldn't chew my way through steel. A part of me had always wanted to dig myself a tunnel out of prison, like in the stories, but that didn't work so well when you were in a modern facility with walls made of solid sheets of cold metal. The lavatory offered no opportunities I could see. Even if I could break the toilet free or rip off the sink, that wouldn't make a hole I could fit through. And there weren't any loose parts on the bunk that I could use as tools. I was going to have to brains my way out of this, not brawn it. I had to admit, it kind of sucked for the galaxy that its fate kept depending on whether or not I could be diplomatic. For once, couldn't I scudding headbutt my way out of a dire situation? Well, I could see no other option. So I barfed. I'd worried it would be difficult, but I was still woozy from whatever they'd done to me. And this, at least, was a mere matter of physical and mental fortitude. With a little effort, shoving my finger down my throat, I got my sandwich to come back up and paint the floor. I left the mess and settled back on the bunk, roughing up my hair and clothing. Then I started groaning. It worked. A moment later, one of the guards checked at the slot in the door. I heard a muffled conversation outside in the Dione tongue, my pin interpreting.
The stun break should have worn off by now.
I hate those things. They don't work right on some species.
What should we do?
Call a doctor, I begged in my mind. Not Braid, please.
Send for the medic.
I exhaled. Yes, it worked. I lay there, waiting, making plaintive noises and ignoring the stench as best I could. But eventually, the smell of it made me throw up again, this time involuntarily. I was pretty sure that a guard was watching that time, though. So I felt proud of my body's warrior instincts. I lay back down, forcibly containing my excitement. I could take down some spindly medic. I just needed to grab them, hold them, and use them as a shield. Then I could manipulate the situation and get a gun from the guards. From there, I could make my way to... The door clanged open, revealing a 2-meter-tall, hulking monster of a burl, covered in fur and built with arms like artillery cannons, with a tiny medic's hat. Well, scud. I took a deep breath. I abandoned the human shield idea and would instead take my chances with the guards. As the burl drew close to my bunk, I flung my legs to the side, slamming them into the backs of his knees. He stumbled into the upchuck on the floor, then slid and collapsed. I was out the door a second later, tackling the guard who had stepped up to check on us. They went down with a cry. The superiority's troops weren't generally experienced. They could drill and perform their station duties, which made them dangerous enough in spaceship combat, but they hadn't done much actual fighting. So this guard went down, and I managed to roll us as the second guard pulled out a non-lethal weapon and fired it, right into the first guard's back. Human shield after all. Well, Dione shield. I wiggled free as the first guard shook and contorted. Then I dodged another shot by a hair and leaped for the second guard, getting in close enough to grab their arm and twist it, causing them to scream and drop their gun. I went for the weapon and shot them in the chest, stunning them, then immediately heard a click behind me. I froze, then glanced over my shoulder to see Braid lounging by the wall, holding a gun on me. A destructor, none of this non-lethal nonsense, in one hand. In the other hand, she held the stopwatch she had clicked. 12.5 minutes, she said. I growled softly. She gestured with the gun, indicating I should drop my weapon. I didn't. Though I also didn't turn it on her. Unlike the two buffoons I'd just downed, Braid would not be an easy opponent. The door to my cell swung open as the medic, covered with what had been my lunch, lumbered out. He wilted visibly at the sight of Braid. "I even warned him," she told me. "And you still got out." "Not bad." I hesitated there, gun in hand. I wanted to go for her, but... the chances of surviving that were low. What good would I do anyone if I died here in the hallway? With a stab of regret, I dropped the stun gun. Braid backed up to the next cell in line, then pulled it open. She waved me in, and after I complied, she slammed it shut. "I'm keeping this stopwatch as a reminder," she said, peeking through the slot in the door. "I guessed it would take you over an hour." "Nice work." "You want real motivation, Braid?" I said. "Let me out. Let's have that duel you promised me." She didn't reply, but neither did she back away. "Let's see who's really better," I hissed at her. "You and me. In starships. You want to know. I can feel it in you." She slammed the slot in the door closed, and I slumped down onto my new bunk, feeling the fatigue after an adrenaline high coming on. I flopped back, groaning softly. "Idiots!" Braid's voice echoed from the hallway. "You get to clean up that mess as punishment, while I see if I can find any soldiers in this division who aren't utterly incompetent. Nobody opens her door for any reason. Scrud. I can't believe I even have to make that rule. What is wrong with you all?" She stalked off, and a short time later, my new guards arrived, 10 of them this time. I almost felt respected. Unfortunately, these guards actually listened to Braid. I tried several more ploys to get them to open the door. Since playing sick had failed, I tried bribery, pretending there was something mysterious in my room, going silent for an extended period, pretending that I'd gotten a hatch open and was about to escape. Everything from every story I had heard, and a few I made up on my own. That door didn't open again. I tried prying off panels,
working at the lock, and even attempted to rip off the sink. When that failed, I clogged the drain and flooded my room. Again, nobody opened the door. All I managed was getting my feet wet. Hours later, I lay there, sullen, arms aching from trying to force the door. "Embat," I tried for about the 100th time. "Embat, can you hear me?" If I could reach him, maybe he could talk to Gran-Gran or Jorgen and tell them what had happened. I got no response. My powers were blocked. Though, this time it did feel different. Not a recovery of my cytonics, but some kind of distant attention? I wasn't certain what else I could call it. Awareness was seeping back into my mind. Maybe the drug was wearing off. How long had I been in here? I was exhausted and had slept for maybe an hour or so in the middle of my various escape ploys. This gave me hope, and I reached out again toward that awareness. Scud, I hoped I wasn't reaching for Braid. It didn't feel like her. In fact, it felt like an impression of being in a box, of fear and pain and loneliness, and a faint familiarity. It was the slug who I'd contacted earlier during the supply depot mission, the communications slug who had asked me to save her friends. She was somewhere nearby. My senses couldn't extend as far as they had before and were limited by the drug's hampering effect, which meant I was likely at or near Evensong, the platform where they kept their communications slugs. That made sense. This was where Winzik planned to gather his forces, so he'd want to be there to supervise. They had brought me right into the heart of their operation. The slug gave me a thrilled little mental trill. Evensong. That was right. I was close, and she was there with thousands upon thousands of others like her, trapped, imprisoned, enslaved. She thought I'd come to rescue her, as I'd promised. I winced, trying to project confidence, then to ask if she could communicate with Doomslug. Unfortunately, at that moment, my door clicked. What? The door was opening. Were they bringing food? It didn't matter. I grinned wildly and leaped for it, ready to attack whoever entered. I got halfway across the small room before a barrage of weapons fire slammed into me. Stun guns. All 10 of the guards had been ready to fire on me the moment the door opened. I flopped to the ground like a fish out of water, humiliated. Then they shot me again. Scudding wretches! I'd stab them in the scudding eyes once I was out of here. I'd simply lie there as they injected me with a new syringe of drugs. One guard deposited a few field rations on the bunk. Then they left, locking the door securely behind them, leaving me, face down, to slowly recover enough to move. I fell unconscious before that could happen, my exhausted body surrendering to the need for sleep.